You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm Abby, and joining me today is my new co-host, Katie. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Katie and I are both librarians at the Central Library, where we record this podcast, and we've got a great lecture coming up later by Justin Reed of Virginia Humanities, and he's talking about the book Something Must Be Done about Prince Edward County. But before we get to that, we'll talk about books. All right, Katie, since you're new to the podcast and a new voice for our listeners, I thought it would be a good idea for us to talk about what kind of books we like to read. And so just to give kind of an idea of what we're likely to hear and talk about in the future and also why we might be kind of prone to discussing those books. So can you give an example or just a brief description of what it is that you like to read?
Sure, yeah. So one genre that I often fall back to is historical fiction. One of my favorite authors of this genre is Kate Atkinson. She's written a lot of different types of books. She does like a detective series, but her World War II historical fiction books are some of my favorites. And I just recently read Transcription, the book that came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
The new one. Yeah, and that was a really great read because it's talking about, you know, espionage and, you know, the British spy narrative, and it's all about a young girl. She's 18 years old, and she's asked to just transcribe. She's listening in on a conversation with an undercover spy and some fascist sympathizers.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, so it starts off where she kind of has a boring job, and she's just transcribing and having a little fun with the notes that she's making. But then she ends up getting involved in the story, in the spy story, and it's because it's Kate Atkinson, it jumps around in different timelines, so it's not just very linear.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am someone who doesn't usually like to read historical fiction, but her book, Life After Life, was like one of those exceptions where it's like, no, I could get into this.
Exactly. Yeah, it's great. If you think historical fiction might be boring or not for you, she kind of puts in her own spin on that genre, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, she is a great example. She's very accessible to people like me who aren't necessarily drawn toward historical fiction. So if you are someone who thinks you don't like historical fiction, definitely check out one of her books. I, on the other hand, like things a little more set in the future. Not like far future, but I love like speculative fiction. So a little bit of sci-fi in there. I'm not big on like hard sci-fi, but the stuff that sounds like that could be 20 years from now. Which means a lot of what I read is also dystopian. And I love dystopias because I'm like, oh, well, things could be much worse, which maybe is not like the best reason to read something, but I love that. I also am often drawn to things with like apocalyptic themes where either, you know, they're taking place just after, just before, or during societal collapse. And so a lot of times the apocalyptic themes and dystopian go hand in hand, but like distinguishing between the two is like a hill I will die on. I cannot stand when something is called dystopian when it isn't. But an example of that I really love that has both dystopian themes and societal collapse, as well as like gene editing and cults and eco-terrorism, is one of my favorites, Margaret Atwood's trilogy, the Mad Atom series. I feel like she just really nailed the genre perfectly. So that's something that I really enjoyed. And also, I feel like it borrows a lot from Octavia Butler's Earthseed series, which starts with the parable of the sower and has surprisingly similar kind of elements with, you know, there are environmental concerns that are driving like larger and larger wealth gaps, which you can understand maybe why like, this would be something that's interesting, right? It's makes sense that it could be a possible future, and I feel like these kind of stories are warnings about, you know, maybe we want to address this before we do have like warring factions of, you know, very, very impoverished people without access to anything, which is sort of where that ends up.
Very cool. Yeah, I haven't read like hardcore dystopian. I've done more like, I guess you call it soft dystopian, like Karen Walker Thompson with Age of Miracles.
Okay, yeah.
So it's told through the point of view of a young girl, and like the days are getting longer. right. or shrinking. And so, yeah, it's how society is changing.
Yeah, it's so interesting. That's something I've gotten more into also, and this is maybe just sort of a take on that other stuff that I like to read, but fiction that focuses on climate change and potentially even climate disaster is sort of like, if this one thing changes, like, what's going to happen to the world? And it's sort of an interesting look at that. So I feel like that's sort of on that, kind of in that vein.
Mm-hmm. Yep, same kind of theme.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. What is the other genre that you wanted to...
Yeah, so the other one I picked, I usually, when I read fiction, I like realistic fiction, but okay. sometimes I often turn to magic realism, because I think yes. it's really fun if you're kind of stuck in a reading rut, because mm-hmm. Magic realism, it's when the author can really be creative, and mm-hmm. you probably find something that you haven't read before. So a few titles that I really like in this genre are Shadow of the Wind by Carlos, I'm going to butcher his name, but Carlos Ruiz Zafón, he's a Spanish mm-hmm. writer. And so this is actually a series. Shadow of the Wind is the first, I think it's a trilogy right now, but it's a mystery, just right. theme, yeah, and it's set in Barcelona around 1945, and where the son of a bookshop owner is sent to what's called the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. Ooh. And so, yeah, so it's this thing that nobody knows about, and so he's asked to pick one book out of, like, millions of millions, and he's supposed to be, like, sort of the book's caretaker. And so he finds a book, but then realizes that somebody's been destroying all the copies in the world, and Ooh. So he's to figure out what's going on with it. And so it's just really well written, too. And it's one of those books yeah. where, yeah, you don't want to put it down.
Recommendation.
Definitely, yeah. And then also magic realism, but a little bit more quirky, is Robin Sloan. I think he's one of my favorite new authors that I've discovered recently. He did Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore.
That's what I was thinking of when you mentioned the other one. I was like, they both have that, like, book theme. And, like,
exactly. yeah, very similar. Yeah, and then also Sourdough, which is yeah. a more recent book. So similar to Shadow of the Wind, and I think with a lot of magic realism, is you have an ordinary character right. who's sort of thrown into this, you know, really bizarre, strange world, and he has kind of end up saving the day or, you know, making yeah. sense of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I tend more toward magical realism also than just, like, straight contemporary fiction. And I think part of that might be that I do like kind of the genre of, like, magical realism has this, like, fantasy element but set in the real world, right? More or less. And I feel like the speculative stuff that I read is similar, right? It's, like, set in a world we can sort of recognize, but there are these new ideas. And for me, it might just be, like, a limited imagination of, like, I really have trouble getting into high fantasy or getting into hard sci-fi because I have to, like, forget my entire worldview. But with magical realism and speculative fiction, it's like, starting where I am, I can totally make sense of this story. And so I think that's something that's really nice and accessible for people who don't want, like, the high fantasy, but it gives you, like, that fantastic element, mm-hmm. which is cool.
Definitely. Yeah. I feel like they borrow from other genres, too. So if you want, definitely. Like, more mystery, or you're yes. looking for a humorous yeah. read that, you know, magic realism often has.
Definitely. That. Yeah. Okay, so the next thing that we've got for you is a recording from an event at the Northside Library, which took place on Friday, December 14th. This was a meeting of Books Sandwiched In, and that is a book group that meets once a month throughout most of the year, to focus on a certain book. It's usually a nonfiction title, and a local expert will kind of give a lecture either about the book or inspired by a theme of the book. And so for this particular instance, and I should say it's not necessary to read the book before you go, which makes it a very, like, easy kind of thing to jump into. For this particular month, the book that they were discussing was Something Must Be Done About Prince Edward County by Kristen Green. And the local expert giving the lecture is Justin Reed, who's the Director of African American Programs at Virginia Humanities. So we'll go ahead and jump into that.
Hello, I am Nancy Damon. Usually I like to just say the introduction, but for a young man so young, Justin's done quite a bit, and so I'm going to read his introduction. I'm very honored to introduce Justin Reed because he works, well, I just missed working with him at Virginia Humanities. Justin Reed is a cultural preservationist and civil rights public historian. As Virginia Humanities Director of African American Programs, he helps develop and support cultural heritage initiatives across the state and manages the General Assembly's African American Cultural Resources Task Force. Justin previously worked for the Moat Museum and National Historic Landmark in his hometown of Farmville, which is what this book is about, Virginia, and oversaw the 2013 opening of Moton's national award-winning $6 million permanent exhibition. He's a former founding board member of the annual Virginia Children's Book Festival and co-founder of the College of William and Mary's Lemon Project on History and Race. So, welcome to Justin.
All right, thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Lindsay, for the invitation. I guess we're all squared away. I know this is being recorded, so everyone, with your questions, just be aware of that fact. Let's see, this book, Something Must Be Done About Prince Edward County, A Family, A Virginia Town, A Civil Rights Battle, came out in 2015. It was written by Kristen Green. And I read it when it came out, and I honestly haven't read it since then. I thought that I would try to reread it again for this particular program. And when I opened it up and began to reread it, I found it to be very emotional. I stopped working at Moton almost 2.5 years ago. And one of the reasons I left Moton, besides wanting to work for a great organization like Virginia Humanities, one of the reasons I left Moton is because this history was very personal. And honestly, it was very emotionally draining to engage in this history day after day and to be responsible for constantly telling the story because it is so personal. It's personal for my family. And actually, many of my relatives are mentioned in this book. That some of their stories or parts of their stories are told in this book. It's a history that's still very painful for a lot of people who lived it. It's a history that, as a child, no one ever discussed with me. I think because it was so painful, there were a lot of lingering emotions, sadness, resentment, so many things wrapped up in the story, and I think it just led people not to share it freely. But through my experience working at the Moat Museum, I had a chance to learn so much more about this history. I began to teach this history, and slowly I started to see members of my own family open up to discuss this history with me. For those of you who may not have had a chance to read this book just yet, I'll just give you as quickly as possible overview, because there's a lot in here. Kristen does do a great job of making this history, a very complicated history, accessible. Let's see where to begin, 1939, a brand new black high school was built in Farmville. It was built for 180 students. But by 1951, this building had almost 500 students. So you can imagine, the single high school built for 180 having close to 500. And for years, parents at Moton High School had demanded that a new school be built or that the school receive an addition. And for years, the county leadership denied these parents their requests. You had students being taught inside of parked buses, because the main building was so overcrowded. You had students being taught in the auditorium. Multiple classes would be held side by side there in the auditorium. You had students being taught outdoors, but you also had these temporary makeshift classrooms that were constructed. The students referred to them as tar paper shacks. The same materials you would use to build a chicken house was used to build additional classrooms for the Moton students. And so you hear stories from students who experience these conditions about them constantly getting sick because they were going from the main building outside to these tar paper shacks. They had poor heating, they had a single pot belly stove in the middle of the tar paper shacks. So students who were sitting too close would be burning up. Meanwhile, if you were a friend sitting right where you are right now, you would have your winter coat on and your scarf in your head, you'd be freezing. Students would have to hold umbrellas inside of these buildings just to keep their work dry because the roofs leaked so badly. So these were the conditions that the students were faced, and they had watched their parents go before county officials, go before the school board repeatedly, and saw how each time their parents were turned away. And so finally the students took matters into their own hands. So Barbara Johns, she was 16-year-old junior at Moton at the time. She came up with this plan that the students at Moton would organize a strike. And they organized the strike secretly over the course of several months. She was really brilliant, but very skillful organizer. She had a secret committee of 19 other students. And she made sure that she picked students from every grade level. She picked students who were trustworthy. She picked students who were highly regarded among the student body. She also made sure that she picked students from different parts of the county. So she had a very diverse as possible within the Moton context. She had a very diverse committee. And on April 23rd, 1951, they decided to implement their plan. And so the first thing that Barbara had the committee do, they had to lure the principal away from the school. And so they had one of the committee members disguise his voice, and he essentially prank phone called the principal's office and told the principal there were students in trouble downtown and he needed to come and get them. And so the principal left immediately. And as soon as Principal Jones left, the lookouts notified the other committee members that he was off the premises and they could move forward with the plan. And so Barbara sent handwritten notes to all of the teachers calling for an emergency assembly in the auditorium. But she only signed these notes with her initials. And Barbara had the same initials as Principal Jones. And so when the teachers got these notes, they assumed it was Principal Jones calling this emergency assembly. It was really Barbara. And so all the students are brought into the auditorium. The curtains open up, and it's Barbara and her committee on the stage. And they order the teachers to leave. They say, "We're getting ready to discuss something very serious. We don't want you to be held responsible for what we're getting ready to do." Of course, some of the teachers refused to leave, but the committee had football players very, very politely escort those teachers out of the auditorium who refused to leave. And once all the teachers were gone, the students had a meeting, and they deliberated, they debated, and they decided ultimately that they would go along with Barbara's plan, and they would strike for a new school. And so again, this is 1951 that these students are nonviolently demonstrating for an equal education. This is 4 years before Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, which we typically associate with being the start of the civil rights movement. Here you have teenagers preceding Rosa Parks. Martin Luther King Jr., he was a graduate student during this time. And so again, he hadn't yet risen to the profile that we associate with him today. He was an unknown figure in history at the time these students were nonviolently demonstrating. And so here they are for 2 weeks, refusing to attend class. Some students are outside marching with placards. Other students simply stay home during this time. And some students are sitting in class but refusing to do work, open their textbooks. So this goes on for 2 weeks. And during this time, the students are meeting with NAACP attorneys. Oliver Hill, Spotswood Robinson, Virginia's two leading civil rights lawyers, come to Farmville, meet with the students. And they're so impressed with the Moton strikers, they agree to take up the case, but they have two conditions. First condition, the students have to get their parents' support, because right now, a lot of the parents are in disagreement with what the students are doing. So you have to convince your parents to get behind you. And the second condition, instead of just going to court for a new school, you have to be willing to sue for an integrated school. And so the students, the committee, they take a vote, and they agree that they're willing to fight to integrate education. So the Moton lawsuit joins four other cases from across the country, a case from South Carolina, a case from Delaware, a case from D.C., and a case from Kansas. And all five of these cases are combined together and argued before the U.S. Supreme Court under the title Brown versus the Board of Education. And so we often only associate this lawsuit with Topeka, Kansas, but it was a class action suit that involved five separate lawsuits that were consolidated and argued collectively. And of the plaintiffs involved in Brown, 75% came from this strike. So this was the heart, this was the core of the lawsuit that desegregated the public schools in this country. And Kristen does a really great job of introducing that history to audiences. But then there's the second half of the history, which is the primary focus of Kristen's book here. She talks about the reaction to the Brown decision. In 1959, Prince Edward County was finally ordered to integrate its schools. And rather than integrate, the county board of supervisors elected to not fund public schools. And so they shuttered the public school system, and the schools remained closed until 1964. So for 5 years, you have over 3,000 children in Prince Edward County being deprived of a free public education. And this is the part of the history that tends to be the most painful, and this is the history that Kristen does a really great job of exploring. She talks about different experiences that individuals had during this 5 year school closing. She talks about her own family's experience during this time period. So Kristen's grandfather was one of the county's leading segregationists, and he helped orchestrate a private school system for the white children. That was the loophole that local segregationists found. The court only said public schools had to be integrated. They didn't say anything about private schools. And so local white residents decided they would establish their own whites-only private school system called Prince Edward Academy. And her grandfather played an instrumental role in helping to establish that private academy. And so Prince Edward Academy opened up in 1959, and it was really this kind of ramshackle operation. They occupied different women's clubs, buildings, and civic halls, lodges. Students were scattered across the county to attend Prince Edward Academy. And so essentially you have segregationist leaders closing a perfectly fine public school system to have their children privately educated in a less than adequate private school system. And this goes on for years until the money is raised to construct a brand new campus for Prince Edward Academy. Public funds were used to provide scholarships to students to attend this private academy. And so ultimately you have black families who are paying taxes and having their tax dollars go into tuition grants so that white students in Prince Edward County could attend this private school system. For black families, you were essentially left on your own during this time period. You had temporary schools open up. We really couldn't call them schools. They called them training centers. You had training centers opening up around the county in churches and beauty salons. Black families trying to do whatever they could to keep the students engaged and learning in any type of way. So essentially, almost like these camp-like operations are being opened up in various places around the county. You have parents doing the best they can to homeschool their children. And so you hear stories from some parents who might not even continue their own secondary education, who are trying to teach their children math and reading. I know one story, the parent talks about the fact that she found magazines for her daughter to read, just to keep her reading. I mean, every day she would require her children to read these magazines at the kitchen table. One of the stories included in the book is Dorothy Holcomb. So her father worked in neighboring Appomattox County, and he and actually his white co-workers found the old, rundown, dilapidated house that they fixed up. And the Holcombs pretended to live in this house for 2 years. And so Mrs. Holcomb's father put a fresh coat of paint, put up curtains, and every day, Mr. Lockett, her married name is Ms. Holcomb, every day Mr. Lockett would take students from Prince Edward County, drop them off behind this house in Appomattox. The students would wait behind the house, and when they heard the bus coming, they would walk through the back door and exit out of the front door to make it appear as if they were living there. And Ms. Holcomb talks about the fact that at one point there were 20 students waiting behind this house to catch the bus. And she said, obviously, they knew that they weren't all related because you had multiple students in the same grade getting on this bus, but the bus driver didn't ask any questions. They just took them to Appomattox County's public schools. And so here you have these stories of resilience, of families doing whatever they could to ensure that their children got an education. You had some families that made the very difficult decision to send their children away. You had host families taking in Prince Edward County black students from all across the country. The American Friends Service Committee set up a host program. The Virginia Teachers Association, which at that time was a black teachers association for the state, they set up a placement program for students from Prince Edward County that were locked out of school. But even then, you had parents having to really make a heart-wrenching decision. In some cases, they decided to send their older children away because they felt that they could handle being away from home. But the younger children remained behind. So within a single family, you see today rifts because some children were able to continue their education while others were unable to. Mrs. Behrman, her story is featured here in Kristen's book. Ms. Behrman was actually one of my third grade teachers. And she talks about the fact that after the school closed, she and her siblings never lived under the same roof again. She was headed to middle school when she experienced the school closing. And so you have all these stories, and there's so many. And Kristen talks about the fact that she was unable to include all the stories that she wanted to, all the interviews that she did for the book. But I did want to share one story. This is Doug Vaughn's story, and Kristen refers to Doug in two sections of the book, so I'm going to read both parts. No one went looking for Doug Vaughn when the schools closed. He lived in a poor neighborhood on the hill above Buffalo Shook Company, the Farmville Sawmill. The saws ran all day until the whistle blew at 4:30 p.m. No one asked if the 15-year-old being raised by a single mother wanted to go away to school. During the week, she worked downtown as a cook at the Hotel Wino, often bringing home pork chops or chicken for dinner. On the weekends, she liked to drink, so Doug and his three siblings had to look out for each other, kids raising kids. Nobody wanted to bother us, Doug said. When the schools closed, he was entering eighth grade. He couldn't count on his mother or anyone else to plan for his future. It was in his teenage hands. Doug asked an uncle in Philadelphia if he could live with him and attend school. Doug scraped together money for a bus fare and headed north, but the school charged tuition when officials realized that Doug was from Prince Edward. He was back in Farmville a few weeks later. When Doug turned 16, he told his older brother, "We've got to get out of here." They left Farmville with a couple of his brother's friends from Mount Vernon, New York, where they rented a room in a spacious house for $10 a week. Doug worked for Good Humor Ice Cream Company, riding a bicycle from neighborhood to neighborhood for 7 hours, selling ice cream out of a bucket. His brother and his friends didn't have jobs yet, so Doug would stop by the house they rented and feed them the ice cream he was supposed to be selling. Ice cream was breakfast and lunch, and Doug never made any money. For dinner, the boys bought heaping bowls of lima beans for a quarter from the corner market. It would be a month before they could afford a real meal. Doug's brothers found a job at a vacuum cleaner factory, which hired Doug too, but soon he would leave the North and head back home for a girl who had stolen his heart. He could barely read, but he would not return to high school. Without an education, the road ahead would be a step. Without an education, the road ahead would be a steep one. So the girl that Doug fell in love with is actually my dad's first cousin, Joanne. And Joanne and my father actually grew up like siblings. When Joanne's mother worked away from home in Baltimore, Joanne moved in with my dad and my grandmother and grandfather and grew up like my dad's sister. And Doug was really like a second father to me growing up in Farmville. When I think back to my childhood, I split my time across three homes. My own home, my grandmother's, and Doug and Joanne's. And Doug was also the best man in my dad's wedding. So I'll finish this story here. When the schools reopened, Doug Vaughn was already married with a child. His wife, Joanne, had become pregnant at 16, and neighboring Cumberland County, where she went to school, wouldn't allow pregnant girls to attend classes. It was important to Doug that she finish high school and get the education he had been denied. She was too smart not to graduate, and he was already thinking of the next generation of Vaughns. Joanne's grandmother, a retired teacher, and this is my great-grandmother that's being referred to here. Joanne's grandmother, a retired teacher, petitioned the Cumberland County School Board, gaining permission for Joanne to attend school while pregnant. "I didn't want my kids to grow up uneducated," Doug told me. After Joanne gave birth to their baby daughter, she started skipping school. Doug adjusted his work schedule from a 5 a.m. to a 10 a.m. start so that he could walk her to the bus stop each day to make sure she climbed aboard. I wanted her to finish at all costs, he told me. When Joanne graduated in 1964, the family moved to New Jersey so that Doug could find a better paying job. He landed a position sewing children's clothes at a garment factory. At night, Doug attended school, working toward his GED, but before he could earn the degree, he had to learn to read. When they got married, Joanne hadn't realized how much difficulty he had reading. So good was he at hiding his weaknesses. Joanne worked to help him become a better reader. At night, they sat in bed, taking turns reading Harlequin romance novels aloud to each other. I was so embarrassed, it was pathetic, Doug told me. I'm a grown man, married, and I can't read. It wasn't just his lack of education that was weighing him down. He was burning with a hatred for white people, who he believed had made it difficult for him to earn a living to support his family. I blame them, he told me. Eventually, Doug and his family returned to Virginia, where Doug worked for years as a brick mason and learned construction, building a house for his family. When construction jobs dried up, he applied to work with the Virginia Department of Corrections, which paid good salaries and provided benefits. After he completed the training academy, his instructor took him aside. "You barely made it through," the instructor told Doug, suggesting that he was not a good candidate for promotion and advising him not to bother trying. The instructor's words were heartbreaking. I hated him telling me that's as far as I could go in life, Doug told me. I'd always dreamed of doing something good and being recognized for it. He made up in his mind to prove the instructor wrong. This guy, I'm going to make a liar out of him. And so Doug did. In the prison system, he was promoted through the ranks. In 2005, he was named warden of a high-security prison in a neighboring county, becoming the first officer in the state's prison system to be promoted to warden with only a GED, he said. As the top administrator of Nottoway Correctional Center, he was responsible for the safety of 1,400 prisoners and managed a $26 million annual budget. He also oversaw a work center that housed inmates who were eligible for work release. As much as he had accomplished, he still wanted more. Over the years, he took college classes at a local community college and at Longwood, but his job was too demanding to keep at it, and he still didn't have a college degree. When the state rolled out a program that paid tuition for residents, denied an education of massive resistance, he enrolled in St. Paul's College, transferring the credits he had accumulated. Now he meant business. This time I will not give it up, he told himself. I'll give up corrections first. In 2008, he graduated with a bachelor's degree in business administration, one of the proudest moments of his life. A few months later, he retired. But for all Doug accomplished in his life, none of it erased what he had endured as a child. He still considers what might have been. I always wondered, where would I be if I had gone to school, completed it, and gotten a college education, he said. Where would I be in life? Despite growing up with Doug as a second father, I had never heard this story until I read Kristen's book. He never talked about it. And honestly, I think for a lot of young people who grew up in Prince Edward, my generation, it was never discussed because I think they wanted to really kind of shield us from this history. They didn't want us to grow up kind of bearing the weight of their stories. And Doug has done really well, and his family has done well. It's his daughters. He has two daughters and three grandchildren who actually is one of his granddaughters just graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. And this is really just one of many stories. My cousin Ricky is mentioned in this book as well, and how he carried a dictionary as an adult. So he constantly gave it up to practice how to read and look up words that he didn't know. There's so many stories, and Kristen also includes stories from her family members who were impacted by the school closing in a much different way. She talks about her parents and them attending the academy and really not questioning the history. And she talks about some of the myths that she grew up with being a white resident in Farmville in Prince Edward County. one of the most popular myths that she grew up with was that the Academy was founded in response to the county closing schools. So it was always presented as if this was the only option. You know, the Board of Supervisors shuttered the school system, so white parents had to do something, so they started an academy. The reality of the situation is that the academy was already being proposed before the public schools had even been shuttered. This was the plan all along, as soon as the Brown decision was handed down, that a private school system would be open for white children. And segregationist Prince Edward County also promoted this as a potential model for the country. They would have delegations from other states come to Prince Edward to see this brand new private school system and say, look what we were able to do. You know, we're able to prevent integration by simply shutting schools down and opening a segregated private school system. You too can do this in your community. And this is the blueprint. Fortunately, in 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a second decision called the Griffin decision, Griffin versus the County School Board of Prince Edward. And the Griffin decision ordered Prince Edward County to reopen its public schools. But it also prevented other localities from doing what Prince Edward had just attempted to do. So essentially, the Griffin decision saves public education in America by preventing similar school closings from occurring. Again, there was so much of this history that I didn't know growing up. The Griffin decision is named after Reverend Griffin and his family. Reverend Griffin was my mom's pastor. He baptized my mom and officiated my parents' wedding. And again, had no idea the role he played in this history, but he was the leading civil rights figure in Farmville, helping to guide the students, not only during the strike, but after the school is closed, he's helping to find places for students to go. He's helping organize these training centers for students in the county. And another interesting personal story I'll just add, fairly recently, I met another William Mary alumna. She had graduated, I believe, in 1965. But when she was a college student, and she's white, she came to Prince Edward to volunteer as a tutor for students who had been locked out of school. And I met her, and I told her I was from Farmville, and we began sharing stories. And she told me where she had stayed as a tutor, and she began describing the street and the house. And I found out that she had stayed with my uncle when she was a college student tutor. I was able to reconnect her with my aunt who was still living, that hosted her when she was a student there. So again, this history has been told before. It is such a complicated story. I've barely just touched the surface of it today in what I described. But one thing I do appreciate is that Kristen made it very accessible. Most of the texts that have been written about this history have been academic. And you know, for large audiences, it could be much more difficult to really get a sense of this history when it's written by academic authors and academic presses. But Kristen wrote a popular nonfiction book. There have been some criticisms, you know, some legitimate, some less so. I'll tell you a few that I've heard. One was that Kristen says nothing about the struggle to revive the public school system. And that's true. She doesn't go into all of the organizing that it took to get the public school system restored. When the schools finally did reopen because of the Griffin decision, they were funded at a minimum level. The private school was still in operation, and considerable public dollars were still going to support that private school system. So when Prince Edward County Public Schools reopened, it was grossly underfunded, and it was a majority black school system, because the majority of white families remained in that private school system for years. Only in recent decades has the school really begun to integrate. So Kristen doesn't go into the history of rebuilding the public schools following the Griffin decision. I've heard critiques about Kristen not talking about the early struggle for black education in Prince Edward County. Getting Moton open in 1939, even though it was too small, was a huge accomplishment. It was something that black families had advocated for, and they demanded that a high school be built. because in the early 20th century Virginia, the popular belief was that black children didn't need a secondary education. They only needed up to the 7th or 8th grade, and that made black children efficient farmers. That was just enough education to make them adequate domestics. And so parents had to fight to get this high school built in 1939. It was built with federal dollars through the WPA program. So there is this long history of advocacy for education in Prince Edward County. Some people have criticized Kristen for not adequately conveying the personal cost that Reverend Griffin paid. Reverend Griffin died relatively young. It was years after the schools reopened, but many people believe that his health did suffer. It's not a belief, it's true. His health suffered as a result of everything he endured during the school closing. His family became a target for a lot of segregationists in the community. Suddenly, loans were being called in from local banks, or banks would cut off his credit. They really tried to pressure him economically in order to get him to quit the fight to get the schools reopened and integrated. And he did suffer because of his commitment to equality in Prince Edward County. And then I've heard some people say, well, Kristen doesn't adequately convey the national implications of what occurred in Farmville, which I disagree with. I think one criticism I have is not necessarily directed at Kristen, but it's really at the publishing industry, that here, of all the stories in Prince Edward County, this would be the story that would receive a major publisher, right? You know, we have a history where black residents have been marginalized, their education has been deprived, they're still dealing with all the negative consequences, and the story that gets the widest release comes from a descendant of the segregationist leaders, right? There's an irony in that. But even with that said, I do think Kristen did a phenomenal job in capturing the essence of what occurred. Those who have criticized her for not including this long timeline of history have usually been academic critics, and that type of book probably wouldn't have been published. There's so much to cover, right? And Kristen had to access it from her vantage point, and I think it was well done. But one of the things I really appreciate is that she offers insight into what local white families were thinking, some of the things they experienced. Because for so long, local black residents didn't have knowledge of that aspect of the history. And I think through the work of Moton Museum, which she references in the end, the work that we were doing at Moton, and through this book, we do have a much more nuanced understanding of the history. The dominant narrative has long been that all the local black residents experience one thing, and all the white residents experience another thing. It was a very kind of basic a narrative that was shared. And we know that the history is much more complicated, much more nuanced. We know that there was a diversity of experiences for black families and white families. We know that there was some very quiet behind the scenes interracial coalition working together to get the schools integrated and reopened. We also know that there were white families who experienced the school closing in very different ways. Not all of the families could afford to attend Prince Edward Academy. They were going into debt to send their children. Families were being coerced to support the academy even when they disagreed with the premise. James Bash, who was the principal of Farmville High School, almost ran out of town when he refused to support the private school system. And he came to Charlottesville and became a professor at Curry. As a result of him having to flee from Farmville. So there are so many interesting stories and so many stories that I think really, really challenged popular conceptions of civil rights history. And I think Kristen does offer us an opportunity to learn more about this history, even if the book that she has written is an incomplete one. But I think it's still a good one. I'd be happy to take questions that you all might have. One of the things that I think also makes this history a little more complicated than we typically think The common narrative is that Virginia closed schools, and very seldom do we talk about the fact that, you know, not only were schools closed in Prince Edward, the schools closed in Charlottesville, Norfolk, and Warren County. The difference, one difference is the length of time. So you had Charlottesville schools closed for a semester versus the five-year school closing in Prince Edward. But it was the state government that shuttered schools in Charlottesville, and it was the local government that shuttered the schools in Prince Edward County. When Charlottesville schools reopened and Prince Edward saw that the state couldn't prevent integration, that's when they decided to take matters into their own hands and said, well, let's see the state of Virginia force us to assess taxes for education. And so what happened in Prince Edward was really in reaction to schools reopening in Charlottesville after being closed for a semester. And these were white schools that closed in Charlottesville, a handful of white schools, to prevent black students from entering them. So even again, you have white schools being closed in Charlottesville to prevent token integration. And so you had those white students being deprived of an education here just so they couldn't attend class with maybe one black student.
I mean, okay, so Farmville and Prince Edward County is one county, but why is it that, I mean, Appomattox, and they
It is fascinating, right? Like, what was in the water in Prince Edward that made it very, culturally, it's very similar to the surrounding counties. I mean, we're still talking about Southside Virginia. I think the fact that one of the Brown cases originated in Prince Edward was probably the biggest factor. And so, you know, county officials already felt slighted. You know, they couldn't believe that local black residents would do this to us. You know, I can't believe you're doing this to us. That's how they were thinking about it. And really, it was a retaliatory act to shut the schools down. It's like, well, we'll teach you a lesson. You know, if you want integration so bad, we'll ensure that you don't have schools at all. I think that was probably the biggest difference. But you did see counties react in similar ways. And so even though Prince Edward was the only one that closed schools for that length of time, you still had segregation academies opening throughout Virginia and across the South. You have Amelia Academy, you know, is one example that's still in operation today. And so even if counties weren't willing to shutter their public schools, they would still model their segregation academies after Prince Edward Academy. And so to this day, many public schools remain largely segregated because of some of the white schools that were founded during that time that continue to exist to this day. So they cherry picked, they picked and choose some of the strategies they saw employed in Prince Edward.
So
Charlottesville, Norfolk, and Warren County. So they had a special General Assembly session that allowed them to kind of rewrite many of their education laws here in Virginia. And so they were able to essentially defund the public school systems that were attempting to integrate. And the courts did ultimately come back and order Charlottesville, Norfolk, and Warren counties to reopen their schools. They said that was unconstitutional. But the state, immediately following Brown, this happened across the South, legislators like kind of were scurrying to enact numerous codes that would allow them to circumvent the Brown decision. So Virginia attempted to do that in 1955. Yeah. And I haven't honestly followed the desegregation of Virginia's higher education. But one thing that is, I mean, fascinating is that it was the higher education typically served as a test case before K-12 was focused on. So NAACP would travel across the country looking at universities that they could pull into test cases. And so often you would see the graduate schools of education being integrated before you saw undergraduate and then K-12. But one interesting thing about Virginia higher ed, and I forget the year when the bill was passed, but Virginia refused to integrate its universities. And you had the NAACP filing suits to integrate those schools. And in response, Virginia enacted a policy that said we'll pay for black students to receive a graduate education outside of the state rather than have them attend Virginia's universities. And so the students at Moton, I think because of that policy, they had incredible teachers, honestly, because a lot of the faculty members at Moton, when the students went on strike, those teachers, they had advanced degrees from Columbia and NYU. I mean, they had all attended these graduate programs on the state's dollar. because they refused to allow them to attend Virginia's public schools. Actually, one of the teachers at Moton was featured in a movie or a book you may have read or saw called Hidden Figures. Dorothy Vaughn, who interestingly is also Doug's aunt. She was one of the teachers and one of the computers for NASA. And so that's the caliber of teachers that these students at Moton had because of that state policy. They would get the best historically black college education in Virginia, and then they would go on to attend very prominent schools around the country.
Talking about spending money to send students out of the state, Robert Reed, who some of you may know, was a colorist, a very important artist, and some of his work is at the Fralin Museum. And he couldn't go to UVA as an undergraduate, so he did go to Morgan State University and got his baccalaureate degree, but the state of the Commonwealth of Virginia paid for him to go to Yale University, and he passed away in 2014, but became the only to the state African-American tenured professor at the School of Art at Yale University. Now, that says something about them, too, because there's only one, but still, that's where the Commonwealth's money got him.
Yeah. And that was something I used to always wonder about as a kid. So many of the educators of that generation were passing away as I was growing up. And I used to be so fascinated. Like, why are all these teachers who, you know, these retired educators, why do they all have Columbia degrees? why do they, everybody attended Columbia Teachers College in Southside Virginia, if you were a black educator? And it was because the state refused to admit them into Virginia's colleges.
Whatever happened to Barbara?
So that's a great question. So Barbara, her story is pretty unfortunate. She did die pretty young from cancer. I believe she was in her early 50s when she passed. But she led a relatively quiet life. So shortly after the strike, her family snuck her out of Prince Edward, and they sent her away. There have been threats made against her life. And actually, her parents' white neighbors were the ones who informed them that there had been threats made. They suggested that they get her out of Prince Edward. So they snuck her out of the county, and she went to Montgomery, Alabama, and finished high school in Montgomery, where her uncle, Reverend Vernon Johns, was the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Dexter Avenue, that was the very same church that Martin Luther King Jr. Pastored. Barbara's uncle, Vernon Johns, had been fired from Dexter Avenue because he was too much of a radical, he was too much of an activist, and they replaced him with Martin Luther King Jr. And so he was a very prominent figure in Montgomery, and that's where she continued her education. She went on to attend Spelman College. She eventually graduated from Drexel in Philadelphia and became a public school librarian in the Philadelphia Public Schools. But one thing that happened shortly after the Brown decision was handed down, their family home was burned down. They were out of town, and under very mysterious circumstances, their home was burned down, and they came back and found the home that had been destroyed. But it was Barbara's dream to rebuild and to have all of her siblings retire and live on that same piece of land. And her siblings tell the story of her being really sick, but then bringing her to Prince Edward to see that the house was under construction. And she was able to see the house being built, but unfortunately she died before it was completed. They do still have that home in Prince Edward County, and her siblings do come back every year and have their family function and reunion. You know, the students in Parkland who organize themselves have been so remarkable, and I did immediately think of the students who went on strike, and also the students who experienced the school closings, because the second generation of students that were locked out of school, they also organized. They actually helped the Kennedy administration get involved. Well, they didn't help the Kennedy administration get involved. They forced the Kennedy administration to get involved. Kennedys were concerned that violence would break out in Farmville if these students remained out of school any longer, and so they set up a private school system, a temporary school system, for black students in Prince Edward County. The students have been demonstrating for so long. But one thing that I do wish, I mean, today's students still face so many obstacles, and I think I'm there at a disservice when it comes to the way we teach civil rights history because we too often focus on kind of individual actions. We'll say, you know, Martin Luther King did this. It's a very kind of top-down narrative that talks about individual figures like a King or Rosa Parks, but it doesn't really talk about the, kind of the grassroots level organizing. Much of it organized by young people, and it doesn't really go into the tactics that were used to advance the civil rights movement. And so I think the Parkland students have been so effective in having their voice heard. And I think about all the other students across this country who are also facing, you know, very, very serious challenges, and how much they would benefit from a civil rights history that helps prepare them and equip them to effectively address those challenges.
But I would say that I'm a 72 graduate at Central Bloomingburg. What that means is I'm on the tail end of that whole process.
Yeah.
Last 3 years was a fully integrated high school, and I counted one of the more positive experiences.
And in Lunenburg, it's interesting. One of the women who talks about, well, several of the students in Prince Edward who were locked out of school, white and black, if you were white and didn't attend the private academy in Prince Edward, you would go to Lunenburg. And so you had students going to Lunenburg County to attend public schools there. And there are a few stories of students who attended school in Lunenburg because Prince Edward shut them out.
Dustin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember in the book, Kristen Green mentions that discouraged her from writing the book because they were just like, why do you want to bring all that up again? And I thought that was so interesting that, you know, she was gung-ho to bring the history up, talk about it, bring it out, as you said, to a generation that hadn't really heard it. But her own parents were very reluctant for her to work on it.
Yeah, I remember that. So I was still working at Moton when actually, that's how I met Kristen. I met Kristen as she was working on this book. And I remember how tense, I guess, the community felt as she was working on the project. People knew that she was working on a book. They knew that she had picked up a major publisher. I think HarperCollins. Harper published this. And I guess as word spread, people became more and more nervous about what she would actually say. And honestly, I think she probably could have written a much more explosive book than she did. I thought she was very fair in her approach. And if she wanted to write a much more scathing book, she could have. And she didn't. But I think people were nervous about what she would say. They were worried about who she would condemn in this book. And I have to give Kristen credit because I feel as if it's an honest betrayal that still manages to humanize, you know, the people that you would typically assume were the villains of this story. In some ways, you kind of get to the psychology behind why they were doing what they did. And, I think for folks that may have been concerned, their concern was unfounded because this was a very... I know good is not the right word, but I think it was, I think this was a fair is the best word to say. I think this was a fair representation of the multiple sides involved in this history. But I think there is a generation in Prince Edward that would like for us not to talk about what occurred there. Kristen doesn't go into great detail, but Moton, which is now Moton Museum, where this history is told, was almost at risk of being demolished. It had been a school up until the mid-90s, and the county had surplused it and was preparing to sell the site, and people in the community believed that the building was going to be torn down. And it was going to be torn down because there were people that thought it was a reminder of this painful history that we would rather forget. And fortunately, a group of women organized to save the building. And they purchased it from the county. They paid $300,000 for it. They purchased it from the county and converted it into the Moton Museum. Yeah, but there were those who would rather see this history and all symbols of this history removed from the landscape. So we've had, so I guess when I was at Moton, my role there had a more direct connection to public schools and advancing this history. But right before I left, the Department of Ed was rewriting the Virginia Standards of Learning. And we had been, I guess, lobbying for years at that point to ensure that more of this history was included in the current state standards for, I guess, 4th grade and 11th grade. Prince Edward County is now mentioned by name in history, is discussed a little bit more than it was in previous years. So I think that's been one success. When I was at Moton, I oversaw education, and the museum was still relatively new, and one of the big things we were doing is working on outreach to get more school systems interested in bringing teachers and students to Moton. And I think they've made great progress in that. You're seeing more field trips to Farmville. Longwood University is now the primary funder of the museum and assists with the operations of Moton. So that's been a partnership that's, I guess, been going on for about 4 years now, 3 or 4 years, along with historically being a teacher's college. And so they're integrating this history into their teacher training programs now. You're seeing more virtual field trips and technology being used. And Moton is also sending, when I was there, we referred to them as Moton storytellers. These are students who had experienced the history. They would come and talk to students. And so you're seeing more Moton storytellers coming to classrooms and sharing their first-person accounts of what occurred. So it's a gradual progress, but I've seen the shift from the time I started in Moton to now.
Thank you all.
That was a really great lecture. I enjoyed getting to hear from Justin Reed. A little background: Justin and I both went on a 7-day bus trip during last summer. That was part of the Charlottesville Community Civil Rights Pilgrimage. Another colleague and I were sponsored by Albemarle County to go on the trip and be part of it so that we could share the experience with the public later, and we're currently working on doing that, so be on the lookout in the next few months for opportunities to hear and learn about that experience, and maybe we'll even get a chance to do something on the podcast about it. But so it was really nice to get to hear from him about something that is so personal to him.
Yeah, that was definitely a great, great lecture. So we'll have a recording from another library event for you in 2 weeks.
Yes, and this podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or to join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org.
That's all for us today. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be
on the same page.